morning.
Good morning, sir.
May it please the court, we're here on an issue with two assignments of error that are both related.
Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
2 minutes, please.
2 minutes, yes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Davis was convicted for violation concerning possessing a firearm while a protective order was in place. As the court's aware, he raised a due process defense, an affirmative defense that the court denied and would later deny jury instruction on. It's really a three-pronged test that the court looked at. First is, was there an assurance that his conduct was permissible? This case can be distinguished a little bit, and the Attorney General has done that from the Miller case and the Palmer case. However, I think that the due process defense still applies. What you have here is really a collateral consequence of the protective order being in place. So Mr. Davis attended court with his girlfriend at the time. She had filed to withdraw several matters from the docket. They believed it covered not only the child support and spousal support and visitation, but also the protective order, which would make sense. Ms. Zuniga had filed the motions, but Mr. Davis attended as a party. It was requested by Ms. Zuniga that all matters be dismissed. And when she stated in her testimony, which was unimpeached, that she specifically asked the court at the end of the proceeding, are all matters dismissed? And the court said, yes, all matters are dismissed. So they left together.
In fact, the court wrote everything dismissed, or words to that effect, on the form order, didn't it?
Yes, sir. And while we will acknowledge that there were only three case numbers on that order and that the fourth case number did not address the protective order, I will point out that both Ms. Zuniga and Mr. Davis were appearing pro se. Mr. Davis attended the event. He heard the question asked by his girlfriend. He heard the response from the court, and they left together.
Let me interrupt you, counsel. It seems to me, I know you've got two assignments of error here, but it seems to me really it's just one assignment of error. And that's because the due process argument you make depends on certain factual determinations. Three-part test, whether the assurance was given, whether it was given by a government official, and then whether the advice was relied upon in reasonable good faith.
Yes, sir.
All of that, it seems to me, in a situation like this becomes a jury question. I realize your second assignment there has to do with the jury instruction, but, you know, I suspect that we're not in a position, given the factual requirements, to do much with your first assignment of error. It seems to me the focus really is whether the jury should have been instructed that if you find these certain facts, that amounts to an affirmative defense. I think probably
yes,
that's
sir.
Where the focus needs to be here.
And so I agree with the court, and I think that the issue is stronger for us in terms of whether the jury instruction should have been given. I think that there was a scintilla of evidence on all three of these elements. More than a scintilla of evidence. Thank you. And I believe that the court I think the court erred in not allowing us, the jury, to have that instruction. They were the trier of fact. They were to determine.
Tell me what the scintilla of evidence, more than the scintilla of evidence, is with regard to the affirmative assurance that the conduct is not prohibited. Not that the protective order had been dismissed, but that he could now possess a firearm.
Yes. I think it applies naturally to collateral consequences. When Mr. Davis and Ms. Zuniga left the court that day, having gotten that assurance, she and Mr. Davis walked out together and then proceeded to be in each other's company subsequent to that date. So if Mr. Davis had been charged with violation of a protective order, I think the defense would apply there. But just as naturally, I think the defense applies to any collateral consequence that comes out of it, because this is a law. It is prohibiting certain conduct, and I don't see why we would just limit it at a charge that only addresses the protective order. I think any collateral consequence would have to come into play. Certainly, the conviction of a felony in the Miller case, the possession of a firearm was a collateral consequence, similar to this.
Let me follow up on Judge O'Brien, if I can. Understand your answer here. Do I understand your answer to essentially be the only thing preventing him from owning a firearm was the existence of the original protective order? He wasn't a convicted felon or didn't have any other status that would have prevented him from possessing a firearm. So when the protective order was, quote, dismissed, in other words, or at least he was told that it was dismissed along, or reasonably assumed it was dismissed when the judge said what the judge said with respect to the outcome of the case, the protective order he understood to be gone at that point, which was the only impediment that existed, and so the assurance was a I guess a conclusion on his part based on what the trial court had said based on the motion that was made. Is that basically your argument there?
Yes, okay. Yes, Your Honor. And while in the Miller case, the appellant in that case specifically sought out a few people to address the collateral consequence, and that somewhat distinguishes the two cases, again, though, the conduct's prohibited because of the protective order. An assurance was made, and if that's the only impediment, he could reasonably believe that he could go off and possess a firearm or be in the company of Ms. Zuniga or whatever. So I believe that there was an assurance. I believe that by him attending court in a pro se capacity that question was asked, he heard the response, and then relying on that by leaving in his girlfriend's company and so on, I think was an affirmative assurance. In terms of the government official element of this defense, it's been raised in opposing counsel's brief that a judge cannot give legal advice, and that's true. A trial judge cannot give legal advice, but a judge is a government official who defines what permissible conduct is on a daily basis. And one of this was by this judge in Fairfax who instituted the protective order to define permissible conduct. He told Mr. Davis, you cannot be around this person, and there, and by extension, any collateral consequences that came from that. And then by coming back in, even though the protective order was not lifted, but what I'm saying is a judge, it would have been one thing if a party had asked the trial court, can I possess a firearm? The court, first of all, probably would not have answered that question and was not in a position to give legal advice to a defendant. But a court does define permissible conduct. So when you hear an assurance from the court, when that question is asked, these matters are dismissed. Yes, all matters are dismissed. And you see language similar to that in the order. The judge is defining permissible conduct for Mr. Davis. So I think that element is clearly met in this particular fact set. The third issue being whether the reliance was reasonable. I'll point out again that Mr. Davis was pro se in the hearing, that they left the courtroom in each other's company. When he was arrested, he was informed that there was a protective order in place. His statement wasn't, I thought that was dismissed, or I didn't know about it, or that was a long time ago. He said that was dismissed and maintained that throughout. So I think that his reliance, by attending court again, hearing the statement, that reliance was reasonable. He acted on that in a reasonable fashion. And I think that the fact that they were looking for this assurance, just to go back to the first element, is backed up further by the fact that upon learning that the protective order was in place, he spoke with Ms. Zuniga, who then went to the court within a month and a half later, I believe, and asked it to be withdrawn. And in her written statement attached to the petition to withdraw the protective order, she stated that they thought it had been withdrawn some time ago and that this was a mistake. So, and again, I agree with the court that I think it was ultimately up for the jury. While I think, in hindsight, there were a few things I would probably fix in the proposed or the proffered jury instruction, I think it's an accurate statement of the law, and I do think that the jury deserved to hear it. They asked a question that very jury instruction addressed. And so I think that there was more than a scintilla of evidence in this case on all three elements. I think the trial court erred in not giving us the instruction, and I'll get back or reserve the remainder of my time.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Murphy?
Excuse me. Good morning, Your Honor. Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth.
Good morning. And I realize we're limited to the record, but why in the world was this thing prosecuted? You've got young people
that is a
trying
good
to do the right thing?
Your Honor, we don't understand the prosecutor's motives here.
It is what it is from your perspective, I guess.
Yeah. And, the judge, I don't think the judge erred.
Let me ask you this. What's the Commonwealth's position as to whether or not there's a clerical error here with respect to the dismissal of the protective order? I mean, there was a motion, or I realize everybody's pro se here, but there's a request made to basically drop everything. The judge on the record says, I'm going to grant that motion and drop everything, but for whatever reason, the protective order was not dismissed. So is that a clerical error, or what? How are we to take that, basically?
Well, the problem is, we have a court not of record. We don't know exactly what was said at that point. We do have an order that the judge said was clear. It dismissed everything else, but didn't address the protective order. There were four case numbers. Only three were concluded there. Maybe it was an error, but we don't know at this point. Maybe
I didn't phrase my question very well, because where I'm headed with all this is I don't think we're in a position to decide whether this defense applied or not. The question really, for me at least, is whether or not the jury instruction should have been given and let the jury make that call. So given the testimony to the effect of, hey, we assumed everything was going to be dismissed, the judge said as much, there was no objection to that coming in, and it's before the fact finder, why wouldn't the jury instruction permitting the jury to assess at least whether there is a possibility or reasonable doubt as to whether this is not a strict liability crime, I'll suggest to you. So if there was a reasonable belief that the protective order had been dismissed, shouldn't the jury have at least been allowed to consider that fact?
Only if the judge hadn't made legal conclusions that the facts would not permit determining the other elements of the defense. That is, that you have an affirmative assurance, which generally requires that the government official say such conduct would be, in fact, legal.
Well, can't that assurance be, you say affirmative, but the law is that he was assured. The question is, I guess, whether you could imply an assurance from the words that the judge says. So if the testimony admitted without objection is that the district court judge says, I'm dismissing everything that's before me, which includes a violation of a protective order, everybody leaves the courtroom with that understanding. Why isn't that a reasonable implication of an assurance?
No, I think that could well be, but the point is that
why wouldn't the jury instruction be authorized?
Well, first of all, legally, I think that would be an expansion of the defense that we now have. I mean, it's very rarely applied, and as you can see in the Miller and Palmer cases, make clear what we're talking about is a government official says, sure, you can do that, that's perfectly legal.
So is it your contention that the judge would have had to have said, protective order is dismissed, and by the way, you can now have a gun?
Yes, Your Honor, something like that. That, in fact, what you need is an affirmative assurance. Because part of
So just saying the protective order is dismissed wouldn't be enough?
Your Honor. What I'm saying is that one of the elements is that the defendant was misled by a government official. Another legal requirement is that that official be somebody who's charged with the responsibility of providing that kind of information to the defendant. In Miller and Palmer, the courts
Let me just understand what you're saying here. So your position is that if the judge had said affirmatively, I am dismissing this protective order, and the only thing preventing that individual from owning a gun is the prohibition in the protective order, your position is that still would not be enough? The judge would actually have to go one step further and say, and by the way, from now on, you can possess a gun if you want to.
Well, sure. The first question would be, could the judge even be the public official?
Why would a judge be a public official?
Well, because the cases have not defined it to include a judge.
But that would be to say that a party cannot rely on what a judge says?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the cases have said that a judge does not provide legal advice. That was one of the bases for the judge's decision below, that, in fact, there are certain individuals, parole officers in particular, whose function it is to provide that kind of information to probationers. And there is no case provided by the defendant.
One doesn't have to walk many steps beyond that to get to the point where any decision of a court can't be relied on. That doesn't make any sense.
It can be relied on, but the point here is we don't have an affirmative assurance that this is a legal, appropriate behavior for the defendant that is not illegal. And the courts, you know, the question is, can a judge be that person? Sure, that's the first question. And you can rely upon on a court's decision, but you cannot claim that somebody misled you by telling you this, because the judge does not have an obligation to provide advice to the defendant, as a probation officer does. But let me get also to the instruction issue, because the main problem with the instruction issue is that the instruction is entirely improper. If you look at the instruction at page 14, one of the facts that the jury must find is that the protective order was dissolved prior to October 12, 2016, which is the date of the crime, the date of the possession of the firearm. Well, of course, if the jury did find that, and the jury could not find that, I mean, it's conceded, it seems to me clear, that it was not dissolved until the subsequent order in January. So the jury could not properly find that it had, in fact, been dissolved at the time of the original order.
Well, wait, there was uncontradicted evidence from the wife or girlfriend, whatever her role was, that she asked the court to dismiss everything, and the court said everything's dismissed. You're saying...
But the order itself did not affect that.
Right, but there was the uncontradicted testimony from the wife that was the exchange with the court. Doesn't that present more than a scintilla of evidence for the jury to consider?
It might do that, but it certainly doesn't permit the jury to find that the order that the court entered dissolved the protective order. The protective order was in fact in effect at the time of the possession. The question is, even though it was in effect, couldn't the defendant rely upon the court's statement as a defense?
And in fact, in this case, didn't the jury come back with a question suggesting that they were wondering about this defense even though there was no instruction on it?
Yeah, sure. No question about that.
Doesn't that suggest that there's more than a scintilla of evidence that's presented then?
Well, again, the question is, were there facts sufficient to sustain the defense? And the court determined that, first of all, there was no affirmative assurance. Secondly, that the judge could not be the appropriate government official. That, in fact, the order, the court's, particularly a court of record, speaks through its orders. The order didn't address the protective order.
Well, this particular offense is not a strict liability crime. I think you concede that. You have
for sure
to have the specific intent to violate the order in this case by knowingly possessing a firearm. And so the defense here is that he agrees he possessed the firearm, but it wasn't knowing in violation of the order because of the assumption that the order was dismissed.
Yes, sir.
There was evidence to that effect presented. There's certainly no question of that. It seems to me, at least in the abstract, then becomes a jury question, and the defense doesn't have to be established beyond a reasonable doubt. It only has to raise a reasonable doubt. So it seems to me assuming the parameters of the defense are met factually, there, you know, an instruction would be authorized as long as the instruction is a correct statement of the law, and it only needs to raise a reasonable doubt as to the specific intent, doesn't it?
Again, what the trial judge did was, of course, he rejected the
defense. Rejected the entire defense.
Yes,
what he
and did. He did so because he thought that legally these facts could not support the defense. So that's different from saying, oh, I find that you haven't proved the defense, that factually you haven't sustained your burden. He said, even if you proved everything you claim, you still haven't proved this defense, because of the various legal determinations he made with respect to who could be the government official, what kind of assurance there would have to be, and had to be reasonable reliance. So I think that's the difficulty here, is that he decided that defense is not available even if you proved everything you claimed. And that's different from saying that the facts... You're factually incorrect. Your facts will not support that. A judge cannot be the government official. There's no possible affirmative assurance here. These cases have not moved to the point of saying collateral consequences are part of the equation. you have a requirement that there be an affirmative assurance, because this is a case in which it's due process, because the government official, the government has supposed to have misled the defendant into taking a step that is illegal after having been assured that it is not. And only can he didn't believe that that was possible under the facts to meet, reach that standard as to what you had to show. So I think it's very different from just the factual determination. And again, one of the reasons the judge rejected the instruction was that it was incorrect in the statement of the law, and it would make no sense to ask the jury to find the protective order dissolved when, in fact, the whole point was that it had not been dissolved, but I have a defense. The jury could not have found him innocent under this jury instruction because they could not find that, in fact, the protective order had, in fact, been dissolved. And for those reasons, I request that the decision be reconsidered. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Garrity, anything further?
Just to briefly address a few issues raised. As I said previously, the jury instruction, it's an accurate statement of the law. It was clumsily worded by myself, but if the court looks at the first sentence of it, and it is an entire sentence, it says, if you believe from the evidence the defendant was given information by a government official, and then it defines a government official between the commas, that the protective order had been. So it wasn't
Mr. Murphy argues that that's an incorrect statement of law for, among other reasons, the judge could never be a government official. That's his position.
Yes, sir.
And if he's correct, then of course that instruction would be erroneous then, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. And again, we think that element is met. We think that the judge is a government official. I mean, it's a branch of the government. It is someone that is charged with defining permissible conduct. Again, I don't think that a judge can dispense legal advice to a defendant or a party to the case, but they define permissible conduct. They make rulings on that, and that is falls under the scope of this due process defense, in my opinion. But I do think the jury instruction doesn't state that the order was dissolved prior, that they would have had to find that the order was dissolved prior to October 12th, just that a judicial or a government official in this case stated that to Mr. Davis. So I think it's a correct statement, although, again, I didn't do a very good job in drafting it, to be honest. Secondly, the court didn't really say it was an incorrect, the trial court didn't say it was an incorrect statement of the law. The court focused on what the Attorney General's addressed, that the judge is not a public official or a government official that's covered by these cases, and focused on a few other extraneous matters. But that was the general concern of the court, the trial court as well, and we think is incorrect. And unless the court has other questions, I don't think I have anything else to address.
No, hearing none.
Thank you.
In keeping
time.
With the tradition of this court in merit cases, we'll step down and greet counsel. Thereafter, we will take up the case of Cody versus the Commonwealth.